His name is Alexis Borsier.
I feel comfortable calling crudity a word.
Since he was a child, he's been raised to consider pop culture as a fine art to be studied, dissected, analyzed, and debated. My name is Ben Spiro. I spent last weekend entertaining a 4-year-old by pretending to be a 7-foot-long green worm that wanted to eat all her toys. Together, we're proud to present...
Hyper Strong Miracle Treasure!
Welcome to Hyper Strong Miracle Treasure, the show where two friends take a deep dive into the pop culture grab bag and hurl random implements of entertainment at one another with reckless abandon. Borsier, how you holding up?
My cat's asleep. My shoes are comfortable. It is a Saturday.
You've got all the bases covered then.
I mean, all the ones that matter. Technical notes.
Unfortunately, due to technical difficulties, special guest Kylie Oram is not going to be able to return this week. It is a shame because we did watch a good 3/4 of the movie together before we realized that it was not going to be possible to get her recording, and that was a shame.
Yeah, there were gremlins in the machines, and it's a real bummer because she was a welcome addition to this conversation and viewing.
Kylie, sorry we couldn't make it work. Hopefully we'll try again sometime in the future. Last week, Borsier made our eyes bulge from their sockets as we gathered together to talk over the entirety of Roger Corman's Fantastic Four as part of the first installment of our terrible movie watch-along battle. But this week, it's my turn, because today we're sitting down for a terrible movie full of pointless sex, violence, and crudity, which should offend just about everyone, both for its content and for its truly abysmal filmmaking choices. I'm referring, of course, to the Canon Films atrocity, Tough Guys Don't Dance.
Oh dear, what are you fine children about to make me watch?
Borsier, we're about to make you watch the 1987 film Tough Guys Don't Dance, written and directed by Norman Mailer, produced by Golan and Globus, and edited by no one maybe? You judge for yourself. This is a film with a respectable 7 Razzie nominations, but only one win, Worst Director. But guess what? Norman Mailer didn't even win Worst Director. He had to share it with Elaine May because Ishtar came out the exact same year. In retrospect, we can look back and say, maybe Elaine May was...
Yeah. Opposite robbed, or some such thing. I kind of like the movie Ishtar, I gotta say.
It is aged much better than its reputation, whereas this movie is still an abomination. In the past, I've made the mistake of recommending this film to others as a nearly transcendent fusion of moral wrongheadedness and technical incompetence. But I realize now I was incorrect to do this. No one should be forced to sit and watch Tough Guys Don't Dance on their own. And that's why we've gathered here today, my friends, to share the pain with each other and the listening audience. To recap, here's how the watch-along works. We're not about to discuss a movie, we're about to watch it together. And this episode is designed to be played concurrently while you watch the film, too. If you feel like signing up for a 7-day free trial of a streaming service called Screen Picks, you're free to do so. Tough Guys is there. But this movie is so little loved that it's just sitting on YouTube waiting for a copyright claim that is never going to come.
It is a group called Collab Film Club. And everything they have on there is vaguely out of print and confusing. Of the movies that I knew that whose titles actually reminded me of something, they were all pretty much terrible. The terrible films you cannot buy anymore. I get a laudable goal.
To synchronize, let's all start together right after the Canon Films logo glides completely into frame. I have this about 13 seconds on the YouTube link. All right, on three. 1, 2, 3. Oh, sweet mama Canon. How I love thee. The line, "Death is a celebration," has nothing to do with anything in this entire film. I just want to...
Oh, no, it's... it's already setting a tone. No, you know, canon, and I assume this is what they thought they were doing here. The beauty of canon is they didn't just make low-budget schlock. They made anything kind of low-budget they thought they could turn a profit
right.
on.
They thought they were making low-budget art with a genius of our time in Norman Mailer. That's what they thought they were doing. And something else happened, man. First off, just to start, the gray expanse of Provincetown just expanding beyond you, it's just like, this is the least noir setting that you could possibly have.
Penn Jillette? What is even happening already?
You've seen this movie, you forgot.
I haven't seen this movie.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know you were completely fresh. Oh boy.
I asked you if I should see this movie before. Oh, you said no.
Oh, this is the greatest moment of my life. Okay. So, I need to set up something for you, Borsia, because it's very dense. And it's going to take a while for it to land. So here's the setup, okay? The opening of this movie is about to occur. We're about to watch the main character, Ryan O'Neill, do some stuff. Now, when he starts to do some stuff, all the scenes that we see are going to happen again in the middle of the movie. And I just want you to compare what we're about to watch with the second time we see it. And I just want to know if you see what I see in it. Also, Francis Ford Coppola was responsible for this, at least partly.
You know, Coppola made a lot of pretty bad decisions. He had too much money, too much equipment, and little by little he went insane. But not just from the one movie, right. Like generally.
No, Apocalypse Now just stretched out into his life. Okay. So notice how we haven't set up this man at all, who he is or what's going on, right? Just keep that in the back of your mind.
All right. First of all, production design is using way too many lamps.
Mm-hmm. This is just someone's home. I know it. Norman Mailer's like, we'll film in the largest home we can find in Provincetown.
Oh, it's what's his name?
Lawrence Tierney.
Yeah. He's definitely the man Norman Mailer invented in his head.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And is there a crueler thing you could do to Ryan O'Neill than have Lawrence Tierney be his father? Like, no.
Set him on fire.
Just how emasculating is it to sit next to Lawrence Tierney and go like, well... Norman Mailer's particular view of homophobia is interesting. This is a theory that I think is going to be expressed later on in the movie, is that I think Norman Mailer doesn't believe there is such a thing as gay men. There are just men who haven't met the right blonde yet.
I believe he coined the term failed heterosexuals. Mm.
There you go. He's about to express this throughout this film. I might have talked over it. Lawrence Tierney's dying of cancer.
I mean, honestly, I just always assume that with all his characters.
Yeah. This entire film is an indictment of Ryan O'Neill's masculinity. Also, I just want to point out, this is a flashback. We haven't changed scenes. This is a... Deborah Sunderland did not win the Razzie for Worst Actress. You know who won the Razzie for Worst Actress? It was Madonna for Who's That Girl?
I mean, it's kind of a trashy delight, but...
Also, I don't know if you've gotten a chance to see it, but Wings Hauser is the best low-rent Busey of all time.
Oh, yes. That's... He's...
Also, they needed more song, so they just restarted the song somewhere in the middle. Notice how he hasn't introduced who any of these people are, like that. Just little tiny things that Norman Mailer does not know how to do.
Okay, we are not even 10 minutes into this movie, mm-hmm. and already it is just deeply, deeply, deeply strange.
Uh-huh. He might be doing it on purpose. Just introducing characters the way you would in a book, right? Rather than the way you do it in mm-hmm. a film. Whereas it's like, you know, Patty Lorraine needed to give parties, and then you show a cut of Patty Lorraine, so we know who Patty Lorraine is, you know? Instead, like, Norman Mailer knows who Patty Lorraine is, and so obviously the audience knows, right? Right?
Honestly, he's stacking people like theater. It's weird.
She's just beginning. She hasn't even started to warm up yet. Also, this change from, like, location to location, like, I don't understand.
Uh-huh. Just with a quick dissolve, uh-huh. too. I mean, just like the kind of stuff that if a student film did it, they'd get slapped in the face.
It's like, no, put it in one location. It continues in that location. If it moves, transition somehow. I don't... The seance. There's some setup that you have to do if you're going to give lines like this. This movie is difficult for me in some parts because Ryan O'Neal is in one of my favorite movies of all time. The Stanley Kubrick movie. God, the name's drifted out of my mind right now. Barry Lyndon. I really love that movie. Apparently not enough to remember its name, but...
I've always felt like Barry Lyndon was pretty but boring.
It is beautiful.
It's beautiful.
And I can understand that. I can understand that point of view. But it, I don't know, it keeps my attention somehow.
Who's this actor?
The chauffeur?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Also, he's not coming back, so...
I think he's somebody.
Hmm. This character of Wardley Meeks, who they're mentioning, is one of the most important characters of the second half of this movie. We will not meet him until halfway through the movie.
Yeah, that's Clarence Williams III.
Oh, I know that name. What's he been in?
He's one of those everything guys.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, just a noted character actor.
Okay.
Empire, mm-hmm. Justified.
Oh.
A lot of TV.
Oh, yeah, he has corpses in the cellar. How can he count his sorrow if he doesn't use shaving cream? Provincetown is just such a strange-looking place. I don't know, it...
I mean, I think he's trying to do that, too. Uh-huh. He's trying to make it noirier.
But it defies the tone he's going for.
Oh, yes.
Oh, by the way, something you should know about this movie is all the characters know each other from moments in the past that they vaguely reference sometimes, but we're just supposed to pick up on.
So wait, are we in a flash? We're in the present again.
Okay, all right. Everything that isn't in their house is a flashback. The flashback is more or less in chronological order from after Patty LaRaine left, until the point where we're going to begin a second flashback. We will flash further back to another time. So right now, consider the storyline relatively linear until second flashback starts, and I'll tell you when. So his wife has left him, and he's drinking and spraying shaving cream on the mirror. Oh, triple X rated. No, those are pathetic.
Those are just fat.
That's double XL.
Can just be double X also. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they don't want to put the L on there. You don't want to make the fatties self-conscious. All right, mm-hmm. Let's see if they go back to the three shot,
mm-hmm.
But someone told that actor the most important thing in the shot was the continuity with his right hand.
Right, you got to keep the hand, right? Or...
Yeah, except we have changed geography like 7 times.
Mm-hmm. What? No, I've never gotten it. It's never been funny.
No, but you can hear Norman Mailer saying to himself, it's funny because it's true.
Uh-huh. And that's him the entire movie long, is just telling us what's true about the world and manhood.
I think that's him in the second half of the 20th century. Yeah, I think I was like 13 the first time I realized Norman Mailer doesn't like ladies.
So have you read Norman Mailer? Because I haven't. Like my
My
Norman Mailer is this movie. This is what I know about him as a person.
I mean, he's one of the giants. You go Tropic of Cancer, Tropic of Capricorn.
That's Henry Miller. I checked. But Henry.
Oh, wait.
But it's you're right in the zone because it's there's a generation of writers who just because they were the first ones to really like deeply explore drugs or sex, like I think got a level of fame that they wouldn't have gotten at any other period of time.
Oh, of course, Executioner's Song.
I think that's him.
The White Negro.
Yeah.
Naked and the Dead. Okay, yeah, I have read a lot of Mailer.
So we are still moving relatively linearly in this flashback. We're still in the flashback. Although we flashed forward in time through, like, him passing out after doing things with the wife. And getting a tattoo. Yeah, so we skipped all that, right? Like, it's... Like, not only are we jumping back, but we're bouncing around forward at irregular intervals in this flashback, which is very hard to keep up with. Mm-hmm. Wings Hauser.
Yeah, this is lit like a family movie of the week. Mm-hmm. It's you know, noir, even when noir is, no, part of noir is it's cheap. So, hey, use these four lights you got and make it look stylistic.
It is too bright to be a noir and too dark to be a regular movie of any other kind.
I feel like I know this guy from somewhere, and I've been trying to figure... I thought he was Mark Alamo, but he's not. No,
that's just pure Wings Hauser, baby.
Yeah. Kidding is kidding. I'm talking about where you keep your grass.
Yep. I just want to tickle my stick.
I think he thinks this is how people talk, right? This is
how men talk.
Yeah, men. Yes.
Ugh. And here's the thing that I didn't realize until this moment. I was like, I was looking over Norman Mailer's Wikipedia just about him and his themes and stuff like that, because I'm never going to read any of his books. And what I understood in the moment I was looking at it is, to Norman Mailer's mind, the most important character in this movie is the police officer. This police officer is his embodiment of manhood. Of unrestrained, psychopathic manhood. So manly, it can't be held back anymore.
It's funny, when I think about it, what my version of Norman Mailer in my head is from him doing, like, chat shows in the 70s and 80s. It's Mailer on Dick Cavett. It's that sort of thing.
This is where he keeps his weed, by the way. It'll attack. Well, but notice, just get all your fingerprints all over that severed head bag and just...
All right. You know what? I feel like that is the most natural reaction to finding a head in a bag that I've... I actually had to give it a couple of beats, but no. I go, oh, that's a head.
Whose head? Whose head?
Like, once I pulled an electrical panel off the wall and a mouse fell out into my hand, a dead mouse...
You went, whoa!
And that was the feeling. Yeah, exactly. It was one beat. He doesn't want to waste shaving cream.
This guy just wanders in from another movie entirely. Like, I think this guy is from Twin Peaks.
No, my memory of Norman Mailer, though, is of the liberal intellectual you choose when you want to say something deeply misogynistic or racist.
Right, right.
That's what Mailer was for.
That tracks completely with what I've seen in this film.
Like, if you want to tell people to vote Democrats, but also those mouthy broads should shut up.
Norman Mailer.
That's who you called in 1978. Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah. Is everything he expresses about masculinity in this movie is so deeply toxic.
One of my mentors in college... his area of popular culture studies was representations of masculinity in the second half of the 20th century. And Mailer came up a lot then. I'm sort of surprised I never encountered this movie.
Mm-hmm. You could write a book. In fact, you should write a book about this movie. I'd appreciate it.
I mean, just, okay... I realize I'm a nerd for this sort of stuff, but this movie is shot like nothing. Not like in a way I don't like or an uninteresting way, just nothing.
Nope.
It's like they opened up the package that said shot order.
you see how we just passed through one room into the other, like,
clarifying
that this is a set, like we're doing some kind of play where they want us to remember that it's a play.
This guy's got an interesting quality.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's go back. Let's go back. Just to remind us again, this is not a real house.
Hey, that business with your foot isn't playing, buddy.
So, from a narrative perspective, he got a tattoo from this guy last night, but they are talking to each other like people who have never spoken before, or at least haven't for decades, you know?
Hey, you don't know. Maybe he's one of those tattoo artists who's very professional and feels like what happens in the chair stays in the chair. Mm.
But not even a line like, hey, guess who's back? just one of the things about this movie is that it's a noir with, like, who's committed the murder that they're trying to frame him for? Well, the policeman told him where to go to find the head. So I was like, oh, the policeman did it. And that's the end.
Okay, are we in the present now?
No, we're still in the flashback. We won't be in the present until we're back in the house talking to his dad. That's when we'll be in the present.
Okay, got it.
And we've got one more flashback to go through.
The house is the framing device. Okay, all right, I got it.
He's talking about the guy who is with the porn star lady who he has slept with.
Also, even in 1987, I don't know why this cop is dressed as Commissioner Gordon.
Yeah, no, it's a weird outfit, right?
I'm sure that's an appropriate dress uniform for something somewhere at some point in time.
I just want to point out, he's counting things in this letter that he finds to be gay.
Okay, they've got all these great light sources inserted, a la a noir film.
Yep.
But then there's a straight floodlight coming from the front,
yep,
meaning they don't matter at all.
No.
They don't matter at all. It's like an alien saw the movie Detour and was like, you know what? You know how it's noir? What? Candles!
So we learn that a lady who we haven't met, who is important to Ryan O'Neill, is married to Wings Hauser now, and just nobody ever told anybody, but they're all connected from things that we haven't seen. I
don't think this movie was made with a great deal of attention to detail.
Hmm. Yet I still love what Wings Hauser's doing. I love it. It's so wrong.
Well, and everything is clearly, like, the second take. Mm-hmm. There are too many weird beats and stuff where you're like, oh, no, you take another one.
We have flashed back. We're in another flashback.
Okay, we are now double flashback.
We're double flashback.
All right, so it's like the second half of Inception.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, we're going one layer deeper into the nightmare. And this is...
We got... Wings Hauser, is that his name?
Wings Hauser has reminded Ryan O'Neill
Wings
about
Hauser
Isabella
and
Rossellini.
Dave Foley. All right.
Dave Foley.
Prove to me Dave Foley and Isabella Rossellini aren't the same person. You can't do it. Can't do it.
You know, a lot of his drag characters would look a lot like Blue Velvet. Yeah.
I'm saying, Dave Foley and Isabella Rossellini are the same person.
Ooh.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because the same basic compositions, which work almost ironically in Twin Peaks, don't work here because there's nothing else there for it to grab onto.
That's
so they just sound awkward.
That's because David Lynch knows what he's doing, and he is purposefully defying something, whereas...
Exactly.
Oh, boy.
Am I still the cute one?
No! Oh, poor C8, wait for it.
Ha! It's the voice of Comedy Central.
We need a trip.
Great.
To go swinging.
Okay, so Penn Jillette stars as a swinger named Big Stu.
Stoop, and there's more. He's got one more layer, and I'm not gonna ruin it for you.
Pleasureful?
You Yankees got tongues like tally whackers. There you go.
All right, now I know why I took the part.
Yep. This is all the Penn Jillette we're getting. It's just this.
I think I'm okay with it. You guys have seen that Penn and Teller movie from about this era, right?
I don't think so.
Oh, it's weird. I can't remember.
Is it about how if you take your girlfriend swinging when in North Carolina on the way home, you'll crash your car and destroy her uterus? Was it about that?
Penn and Teller Get Killed.
Okay.
From 1989.
Okay, I've heard of it. I've seen it in Blockbusters back in the day. Yeah.
They've gone to great lengths to make sure it remains out of print. Mm. So we'll have to watch that one at some point, because it's special, guys.
Ooh, ADR. That's some rough ADR. This is such terrible accent work.
Yeah, but at that point, it really is like complaining about the ashtray in your, on fire Ford Mustang.
No. I think this is how the Mustang caught fire.
Yeah, it's okay. Again, the ashtray, it's bad.
Yeah, but she is giving this terrible movie full, Blue Velvet emotions. It does not deserve Isabella Rossellini.
Because Isabella Rossellini is Dave Foley. Yeah, I know.
She lost her uterus.
Hey, look, some people just do not pay attention the way you and I pay attention to things. You just misplace stuff.
Left it at the bus station, perhaps, you know?
Especially when she's angry? Seriously, man, that's just Dave Foley.
Again, we're in a flashback within a flashback where we're jumping forward in time very, very quickly. And without any kind of guidance to what's happening and how long it's taken to happen. And we're going to do it again.
He thinks he's making blue velvet. He thinks he's making blue velvet.
And again, like, that 3 seconds was supposed to be 3 years of time before they've seen each other again, and it, like, none of it makes sense. More sophisticated.
Puddle in your pants?
I have occasionally puddled in my pants. Occasionally.
I don't think that means what you think it means.
Oh. Oh.
I think it's a euphemism for urinating.
Oh! No, that's pretty much what I thought it meant. This is great. Because she's about to be coached on her acting. And when she acts better, she is in fact going to act so much worse. It's so embarrassing.
I had a professor in law school who was one of the smartest women I've ever met, but she had this kind of accent, and I gotta say, you sound like fucking Foghorn Leghorn. I don't care how smart you are. I assume you're breeding possum somewhere.
Also, we keep mentioning this Wardley Meeks, who he's known since high school, but we haven't seen him. But again, he's going to be the most important guy for the second half of the film.
Are we going to get a weird, interesting actor, or is he just some other guy now?
He's just some other guy, but, you know, we love Wardley. I don't think we love the actor so much as we love Wardley Meeks. Wardley!
That is a hair choice.
They met each other like 3 years ago. Then after he got out of jail, they met up again. And then he's been their chauffeur for an undetermined amount of time before she decides to get divorced. Possibly screwing. Well, certainly screwing. Also, Wardley is the second character who is just a gay man who finally met the right blonde and then fixed it, apparently.
I have to keep reminding myself that this is not self-aware.
Nope.
Like,
nope.
I have to keep reminding myself.
This is why it's of the room caliber, because this is a man who knows he's doing it right. He knows it. All right, we're out of second flashback. We've returned to first flashback.
That phone is great.
It's a pretty solid phone. I have no idea what kind of relationship Isabella Rossellini has to Wings Hauser in this movie. Like, is he abusive? Does she hate him? Does he, like, it doesn't make any sense. And because we fast forward through to another Dave Foley wig, like, I'm just...
They're even equally coquettish. Mm.
Missing me. So this is not a mystery of who beheaded the blonde lady. And yet, we're supposed to continue for another 40 minutes or so. Yeah, well, who could it have been?
God, Foley looked great.
Yeah. Okay, I asked my friend Dave this question the other day. In a moment of, well, it's finally come to this. So I guess I'll ask you, because I think you have important feelings about this. Of the kids in the hall, which looked best in drag?
Oh, Dave Foley.
Okay. He also said Dave. Now, I have a dark horse candidate, and that's, I believe at his best, Mark McKinney beats Dave Foley, but Dave Foley is better on average.
Mark McKinney, okay, look, if you want to marry a woman and homestead outside of Guelph, Ontario, Mark McKinney can be your fucking wife. Dave Foley looked hot.
Here's the thing. Dave Foley looked great most of the time. Most of the time. Whereas Mark McKinney sometimes was beautiful and then sometimes hideous. Sometimes the most hideous creature that has ever existed. And I believe that's why we take away points from him. Sometimes he was a chicken leg.
No, No, Dave Foley just looked really hot in drag, like all the time. I mean, look at this movie.
Look at this. He looked like Isabella Rossellini. They explained it. Oh boy, it's time. Oh. Is this your first time with Oh God, Oh Man, Boursier?
This is my first time with this movie!
I thought you might have seen that clip, like, in some other context, because it is... Alright, so Boursier, here's the deal. That cut, Ryan O'Neill begged Norman Mailer to get rid of it. He begged him. And Norman O'Mailer put it in particularly to humiliate Ryan O'Neill.
I like to believe that Norman O'Mailer was the editor.
Norman O'Mailer. And who's this lady? I don't know.
I don't know. She's got a hat.
She's this lady with a hat. Murder one. Also, kind of gives away the game if he just sees you sitting in the millionaire's car. But I don't know.
I don't think they're terribly concerned about subterfuge at any level in this movie. No.
And yet that they're pretending like it's the big sleep, like oh, it's a labyrinthine passage of acts. Who knows who committed what and when?
That's because these are men, Ben. These are men, so they're doing what is to be done, even if there's subtle or whatever ways to, you just do it.
Just do it.
This cop is making wild choices.
I just can't, you know, it's stupid. It's stupid to get caught up in a plot hole in this movie. Like, it's maybe the most embarrassing thing for me watching it. But I can't get over the fact that Wingshauser's plot is to get him caught for murder one, for killing that blonde lady and putting her hit. Murder one. But he's got him. Like, he's got his fingerprints on a bag containing a severed head in the place where he keeps his weed, and he was seen with them the night before. Like, he's got it! Why is he stringing it out?
Because then there wouldn't be a movie, true. Ben. And yep. They're men!
Yep, and
they're men. No, it's because they're men!
He does what men do. Yep.
That's just tough guys. Some of the other men do dance.
See, that's the problem with Ryan O'Neill, is Ryan O'Neill's character dances. I love this scene. They must drink as men do.
Patty Lorraine is a stupid name.
Yes, it is. Although not as stupid as Patty Erlene, which was also her name in this movie.
I am. It's been a long time since I've felt sympathy for actors in a movie. Mm. And I feel incredible sympathy for everybody in this motion picture.
Right, like, for different reasons, too. Like,
uh-huh.
For Isabella Rossellini, it's because she's trying so hard. She's giving everything. And for Ryan O'Neal, it's because he is being tortured.
Well, and I'm trying to think of an equivalent, and there just isn't one for the level of fame involved here. And the level of, like, sort of direct, I don't know, societal respect. Mm-hmm. But like, if Norman Mailer's making a fucking movie,
yep,
a noir film, you gotta feel like you made some solid choices to get there.
Right. All the pieces are exactly the right pieces. It's just they've been combined in exactly the wrong way.
Yeah, this is poor direction. And it's interesting to say, because I feel like poor direction is sometimes kind of ephemeral, because mm-hmm. it's such a collaborative process. But you're just like, oh, the guy in charge doesn't know how to make a movie. And has no interest in doing so.
It's like, it's also poor writing, but it's for a very different reason. Like, it's like a writing whose time came and went.
Did you ever play the game Deadly Premonition?
Is that the one where you go around with a camera and you can't see a ghost unless you have a camera? Is that?
No.
No, okay. That's a different one. Why?
This, it's reminding me, okay, Deadly Premonition, at least at first, was one of the most poorly reviewed games ever. Mm. And no one can still really figure out whether it is actually kind of genius. Mm-hmm. Or so bad it shot the moon. But it has sort of turned into a classic. And it's got pieces, parts that, like, there's almost definitely influence.
Right.
It's that kind of thing where I'm just going like, oh. I think it also increases the possibility that Deadly Premonition is genius satire rather than one of the worst games ever made.
Right. The line is thin.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's actually kind of a solid shot.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like it.
I don't know. Like, if Crispin Glover was touring and doing press for this movie, mm-hmm. and he was the director of this movie, I think we'd all be talking about it like low-level artistic genius. Mm-hmm. It really is. The fact that this is made without irony, that's impressive.
Also, he has a dog. We haven't been introduced to this dog beforehand.
What was that sound effect? What was
That's the sound effect of looking at a head.
Oh, yeah, no, this is crazy. it doesn't let down, I'll tell you that much. Like, this is crazy.
Right, and that's the important thing, because I feel like if you just watch it, like, oh, and you say, well, that was a bad movie, a point has been missed somewhere, right? Like, there's something special happening here.
Oh, yeah, yeah, no, and that's why it's always scary when someone tells you, watch this movie. It's bad in an interesting way. Because mm-hmm. so often you're just stuck watching 90 minutes of a bad movie.
Uh-huh.
And then you go, you were right. Like, what?
And we're about to get to my favorite dumb editorial mistake in this entire movie. We're about to get to it. Because it's so subtle. But you'll see it, I think. Because, by the way, we're still in a flashback. Oh, by the way, he's got two heads.
Okay, have we heard about why he would have another head?
No, but one is Patty Lorraine.
Okay.
And the other one is the Lady Jessica.
He's got a lot of heads for not a murderer.
Mm. More than is usual.
You know what? I've done that version of sleep.
Okay, here it is. Notice how the shot is first setting up the outside world. I mean, giving you an idea of Provincetown, right? The waves crashing. We see a man rise. He looks outside. This is his home. This is where he is. I'm just reciting the script to you right now. He turns, walks down to bed, lies down for a second. Heads to the bathroom, writes something in the mirror. Why does he do this? We don't know. There is a mystery at this point. We don't know who this man is. Maybe this is his home. What a strange thing to do. He hears something downstairs. He doesn't expect this. Who could it be? He starts to creep downstairs. There's tension. There's the question in our mind, who is the person who is down in his home? This person does not know who has entered his home. This, Boursier, is the opening of the movie. They put it in the middle of the movie. And they put the shot from the middle of the movie at the opening of the movie.
Huh.
It's beautiful. It's the stupidest mistake that a person could make. We're out of the flashback now. Now it's linear from here on out.
Okay, so we're in the present.
We're in the present. We'll have another flashback eventually, but right now.
Like, it has the pieces of a movie, mm-hmm. sorta. There's people saying things to each other in clothes. They go to other places. Just without a hint of irony.
Nope.
I look at you and see a silly hat.
Also, while it's rough to get rid of a body, I think I could get rid of a couple of heads.
Right, especially if you had a boat.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of heads.
You would take six to a couple of heads, yeah. Who could have been the murderer? I can't guess. I never heard it until this moment. I love the bird sounds that they've purposefully added.
Yeah, and they're way too loud.
They're so obtrusive.
They're way too loud. It's All right, they had him for 2 days, and all these things are being shot out over one weekend.
I just deep six to it. You were enough of a man to deep six two heads.
I almost wish I had seen this before so that commentary would be better. I just keep getting lost in this movie.
Right? There's just so much incorrect. Well, okay.
This movie is bonkers.
Yep. What a bizarre height for a shot to occur.
They decided to shoot from a rooftop because they didn't have a crane.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep. Nope, that's it. Also, this is happening now. Wardley is now the most important character in this film. Looks like a YMCA.
See, what a cool shot choice that's just wasted.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not doing anything else with it.
Yep.
They just went like, oh, that frame's great. Okay. Yeah, now just don't do any lights or anything. Just point a camera.
It's just perfectly natural light. That's all he ever uses. Everything looks like a gray day in Provincetown. Everything.
I think it's really telling that I've seen this actor in tons of things since now, since, and he has never done a southern accent again that I can think of. Oh, he's just a character actor. He's in lots of stuff. He shows up in a lot of TV. Yeah, he's a that guy. Like, anytime you need a president to have, like, a third advisor to say a couple of important things, he's on the West Wing a lot.
Oh, okay. Okay, so we're about to get a flashback, kind of from Wardley's perspective, but kind of just filling in all narrative gaps of everything that has happened that we don't know about. And I love how unabashedly pathetic his character is. Right, like, these two characters have an entire relationship, both happening during the events of the flashbacks we've seen, and before the events that we haven't seen, that we don't understand. Here we go, here's a past that is shared, I guess. He's trying to explain why he can have flashbacks of events that other people have experienced, but not him. Do you remember in Hunt for the Red October when you just kind of lower down on the guy on the guy's lips while he's speaking Russian, and then you pan back up and he's speaking American?
Sure, sure.
They just tried to do that with the past. Just. In retrospect, it doesn't make any sense that this movie was in anything other than, like, linear form. Because it's not like they preserved a mystery.
But I don't think they know that.
No. No.
Like, the mystery is actually so poor in this movie.
Yeah.
That you assume there isn't a mystery. And you're like, oh, it's a different kind of thing. It's more like a Columbo.
Right, or, okay, like a Columbo, like we're seeing, obviously, how it was, okay. We're just a couple scenes away from the most important line in cinema. Yay!
I am definitely going to, in my life, say, I am so wrong for this sort of imbroglio.
Like, if you just thought back, I think you'll find you have said it. Like, your life in particular. You'd like to deny it.
I think I may have hit the age where in order to use a webcam, I gotta do it at an angle.
Mm. Also, again, all these people have pre-established relationships that we don't understand.
Well, and if you just watch Twin Peaks on a 25-inch TV set that you keep in the corner because you're Norman Mailer and you don't really care about TV, but you like to be able to see yourself on it, I could see how one thought they were translating what they were seeing over there mm-hmm. to this.
This 87.
This is before Twin Peaks.
So, okay, wait. Are we establishing that David Lynch is a thief and that he has stolen everything? Everything that was great about Twin Peaks from this movie?
I mean, I now have decided 100% that he saw this movie.
Oh.
Yeah, I get 100%, especially if it's here being used unironically and there being used with a definite tinge of irony. Holy fuckballs, we just found the origin story of Twin Peaks.
David Lynch, on advice from the guy who did sound for this film.
Like having a cup of coffee one day, like, you gotta check out this Mailer picture.
He is an important artist of our time, so I'll watch his... Oh, dear God! David Lynch is always deaf FBI guy David Lynch in my mind.
Oh, shit. You know what? Or it turns out David Lynch's entire career is, in fact, what I thought about halfway through this movie, which is, this is such an insane series of choices that I bet if you pitched it right, it would seem like art.
Uh-huh. Right. Like, no, it just takes somebody who understands enough about film, just enough, is like, what if I do this as a challenge? Could I make Tough Guys Don't Dance, but amazing? There would be mess, though. There would certainly be mess. I don't know, depends on the caliber. If we're talking a really tiny caliber.
Again, attention to detail.
You play with me?
Also, all the wardrobe choices in this movie reek of bring your own stuff from home. What's even happening now?
They're okay. All right. Okay. I think I've got it. So, Ryan O'Neal cuckolds the older gentleman right in front of his face. That evening, they get into the argument. Then they pick her up after she murders the older gentleman, right? The older gentleman gets stuffed in the back of his own car. She blows off Jessica, the lady's head. The night before...
All right, I'm going to need to get some note cards and some red string before we try this. I still don't know what's happening.
Also, they're in love. Again, what you might not have noticed is that they are in the exact spot, which is his weed patch.
No, I get it. Okay, it's all the right. Weed patch head spot. Oh, it's head spot. It's one of the three sets.
Oh, weed patch head spot.
This guy's doing stuff again. Mm. I hope he turned into an actor.
The twitch is impressive. Yeah.
Not just everything about him. He's doing something, and it's not as crazy. I think he knows what movie he's in, and I don't think anybody else does.
I will say this, I have never understood how the cocaine deal in this movie it has supposed to work. Like, I don't know who has it. I don't know who is buying it from who.
I am lucky I knew what this movie was, or at least a little bit, when we went into it. Otherwise, I'd be trying to follow.
No, oh, don't do that.
That component.
No.
And
no, which is why it needs to be watched with friends, because then you can stop. You can stop trying to follow the things that happen and just enjoy.
I see how a smart guy in 1987 could sit down into this movie and be concerned he just didn't get it. Mm. Like, there's enough weird shit, and it's Norman Mailer. And
it's how you end up in a cult, really.
Yes. All right, I'm going to start saying about people that they're off on some kind of toot.
And I'm going to go into business with Unspeakable Sleazos. It's everything he says is gold.
Okay, we're in the present.
No. We are still on the beach where he is holding a gun at Tim O'Neill, at Ryan O'Neill.
Okay.
And
all right, that's the present.
And he's telling the story both of what happened to him and other things he couldn't possibly have known.
Oh, man, I feel like I drank a whole bottle of cough syrup. I'm just like... just like, what the fuck?
Right, like, and because of the way it's structured and paced and how lines are delivered, you can never tell whether these people are actually, like, what the relationships actually are. So it's like, are we supposed to trust her that she is in love with Officer Regency? I don't know.
Yeah, like, if I knew anything about these people, how they acted, how they knew each other, or what they were about,
right,
these might be some interesting choices being made, but right, as it stands, honestly, I'd be more comfortable with them walking into the room and reading their attributes off of a card. Mm-hmm. I think it would play better.
Who has the cocaine?
How'd they get it, and why is it?
I don't know.
To be fair,
yeah,
that is the most compelling argument I've ever heard for be a coke dealer.
Right. Like, it's basically the premise of Scarface.
And blow. And the first Paddington, which is weird.
Mm. Dark. Oddly dark film. Paddington also had death guts.
I appreciate that Paddington 2 is weirdly the best movie ever made has actually turned into a bit of a meme now.
Mm.
'Cause it is. It's weird.
I have never seen the Paddingtons.
First Paddington is a movie. Mm. It's well made, but sure, whatever. The second Paddington is really, it's like, yeah, it's like maybe one of the 10 greatest films of all time. And just quietly, it just,
because I've definitely heard, like, you know, online people saying that, but I've never watched it.
All right, well, now we have just discovered that one of the three of us is a disembodied voice we will never hear. Ever. So understand that this commentary is now with the ghost of Kylie Oram.
All right, so this guy has $100 million. I don't know why he's involved in this scheme at all.
You know what? Hey. I will give this that one because he did say earlier, you know what? It turns out when you're like super rich, then you want to be like super, super rich. So at least, you know, they had him give voice to it. I'm okay with that.
I feel like because I'd like to throw parties and it's exciting is maybe not the best reason to get involved in a noir. Like, you need some kind of, like, dark reasoning underneath everything. But I can't tell when she's supposed to be doing bad acting.
No, it is rough. It's rough that that's a component when the actors aren't great.
Right, because that's one of the true signs of a great actor, right, is when they can pretend to act poorly and you know, like, oh, they're really doing this well. Because they're taking all their powers of illusion to make us think they're not good at this. And then when you have a bad actor do it, it's just like, the ramifications are even more visible. Like, he's the centerpiece of this film now. It's just, but who is he?
No, it's fantastic.
Also, Patty Lorraine was the centerpiece of the film, and she's just out. This entire film, on some level, is Norman Mailer attempting to shame every character he would think of as unmasculine.
Yeah, it's definitely, again, it's got a perspective that's sort of so peculiar, it seems like it must be over the top. I have to keep reminding myself that none of this is supposed to be funny. Like...
Or it is, but it's supposed to be a witty laugh, like a cocktail party laugh.
Uh-huh.
Right? Like, oh, a clever bon mot has just fallen from my lips, but it's not that.
No, not even sorta.
But this, I don't know. There is something about this scene. It's like these two weak men united by nothing other than the fact that, you know, they're not strong enough for Norman Mailer's taste. Like, the bonding is real.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is. This is definitely a specific indictment. He's like, you know, it'd be fun if my characters could sit down and talk about how they feel about this movie right now.
And then that just happened.
I mean, like, you can see how so many of these choices seem like they're being made, for lack of a better word. Like, you can see how he thinks they're clever. They just aren't clever.
Because that's the thing. There are so many choices being made. He is trying to convey messages to us. The messages are stupid, and the medium is incomprehensible.
And Dave Foley's back.
Yeah, no, it's weird.
Yeah.
And Ryan O'Neal looks just enough like Scott Thompson.
Yeah. Especially now that we have some shadows for the first time in the movie. Mm-hmm.
Jerry Sizzler.
Yeah, I think it's notable that this whole movie I've been trying to think up a Dave Foley quote or two for her to say, and I cannot, because he did not really do that kind of character.
No. Well, she could talk about how she's not an experienced cannibal. That would work.
That's the right one, actually.
Ah. Let's do it after she kills Regency, because that's what's going to happen. See, this is what Norman Mailer thinks a man is, right? That the person who is just yielded to their own psychopathy.
Uh-huh.
Psychopathy? Psychopathy.
This movie really is just so bonkers. But, like, in every way, like, this shot right here, this is, like, straight out of a Neil Breen film. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just so... It lacks any awareness whatsoever.
Like, for me, I get caught up in the narrative. Like, I'm also fascinated by the directorial choices, but I'm more fascinated by Norman Mailer as a writer, and what he's trying to convey to people.
Like, I'm impressed by that too, because this is a man who has a bad message conveyed poorly within the construct of a carefully planned movie where no choices were made.
No. No, it wasn't brilliant.
Did you ever see that Lifetime movie that Will Ferrell made?
I remember that it happened. I don't think I ever watched it.
Yeah, though. You should watch it. It's... We should... Oh, no, we should watch it together. We should do a watch-along of that weird fucking thing. Oh, Johnny, you know I love my big beef and cheddar.
He's so destroyed by the loss of Patty LaRaine that he has had a stroke.
Oh, Christ on a fucking cracker. This is not okay.
But none of them were good.
Oh, yes, yay! Not okay.
Like, isn't this better than any Kids in the Hall sketch on some level? Like,
oh, absolutely.
Ooh, la, la.
Is this the same day? Has it been several?
Yes.
Okay, just take him to the hospital. I don't
know. She shot him. Like, Francesca Fiore shot him. And for the life of me, I will never understand why they're playing the graduation music at the end of this. Like, has Ryan O'Neill finally become a man? Like, that's what this is? Like, as... Her fourth hairstyle of the movie.
These cars are wild to me because all these... because my family had a deep commitment to the Oldsmobile brand, and Oldsmobile is clearly paying for something here. And so this is just every car my family owned.
Oh. She found all the money from the Coke deal that was never spent on a Coke deal, and now she bought the house for them.
They really are. They're playing pomp and circumstance. It's just there. It's just...
Yep. And now, as we fade out from this film, just a haunting version of it. I don't know why.
Because it's deep, Ben.
I guess so.
Deep.
What is this shot? What is this shot? What are we staring at? I As he walks to the door, closing the ghosts of Helltown out behind him. I guess. I don't know.
Well, anybody marries a rich broad deserves what they get.
Mm-hmm. Like, don't you expect it to break out into the rap that follows the end of the movie now? His name's Tim Madden, and he's going. Also.
Oh my god, this is a Zoetrope production.
Mm. Yeah, because, you know, Coppola. That's how Patty Lorraine is spelled? Oh my. Oh, big stoop. The witches' voices. Okay, so those were the voices of the witches. Anytime we heard the whispering, those were supposed to be the Greek chorus of the witches.
Wait, was there an actual supernatural component to this?
I think so. I think it was truly supposed to be. But it's just so convoluted and strange, layered in so many different flashbacks, that how could you even tell?
All right, Ben, it is my firm belief now, my firm belief, that the show Twin Peaks is a direct parody of this movie.
I love it. I'm in. It makes as much sense as any explanation I've ever heard about what Twin Peaks was for, including the ones you've made to me previously.
Oh, you mean that I know exactly what Twin Peaks is about, and now
yes,
it's a bummer?
Yes, your argument that you know exactly what Twin Peaks is about, yes.
It's a bummer.
Artificial dog created by Debbie and Jim Bolden. Shot on location in Provincetown? Oh, are you sure?
Ugh, the actor studio. And John Peters, you poor dears.
Tough guys don't dance. Canon Films. Mwah. Chef's kiss.
I kind of want that cell.
So, do you understand now, Borsia? Do you understand what I love?
Oh, I understand. This is now one of my favorite bad movies. Okay. But also, okay. I think I have to watch it like a dozen more times.
Right. And I think it's also important to understand, like, why I know I made a mistake when I say, had our friend Jake watch it. And he watched it, and he's like, what was that? Like, how could I have enjoyed this thing? Because it's not made to be watched like a movie. It's made for this, and this alone.
Because, yeah, if I was just staring at that movie for the very first time in my own home with my cat, that's not a pleasant experience. It's
trying desperately to weave a narrative out of something that cannot have one.
Yeah, I feel like this is a movie that's trying to gaslight you. And the Norman Mailer of it is the very first step. Where it's just, there's a serious movie happening here. But there is no serious movie happening here, Ben. There is not. Oof. This is not a very good movie. It's good Norman Mailer didn't make other movies. Or maybe he should have, but like in a lab? Like, so that we could carefully track it like we do with smallpox. You know what?
Mm-hmm.
The Room is a better directed film.
This is an intense argument.
Okay, okay. The Room is a more narratively driven film.
I will say this. It is cohesive in the fact that it, just by its linearity alone... Right? Like that it just moves forward. Does it move forward to places that make sense? No. No, it does not.
I think what we are seeing here, it's a thing I see in doctors, is somebody who is an absolute master in one sphere in their life.
Yeah.
And has not even been challenged except by people doing it for sport.
Because how many people around who are there that can speak on their level? But no one.
Exactly. Tries to do something totally different, and there is no one in the room who can even tell in the moment. Like, I don't know, he might be a it's Norman Mailer. I don't... Hey, you want to tell me that I have to explain to Norman Mailer how people speak and how story is made? Because I'm not comfortable doing that.
I can't recommend enough the trailer for this movie. Watch the trailer for... In fact, this will be my plug. My plug is watch the trailer for this film. Because what it is Norman Mailer sitting after a viewing of Tough Guys Who Dance, reading the comment cards. And like, one of them is, whoever made this movie has never read a good book. And he just tosses it aside dismissively. It is a thing of beauty.
I love it, because I could read that from this only from viewing it. Like, oh... Yeah, this is a movie that is going to is 100% certain of its genius and that it needs no feedback. Like, nope. that is this film.
It points at you and says, no notes. Got any plugs, Borsier?
Ah, nah.
So, from Two of the Bungled, to all our botch friends out there, we love you.
We do love you. You should probably watch this movie with friends. Or a packed theater. Oh, glory, glory, a packed theater.
No, like, this should have the Room treatment, right? Like, or a Rocky Horror treatment, it should.
This is a special film you've shared with me.
I believe it. I believe in Tough Guys Don't Dance.